It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Will Kane.
I'm Janice Dean.
I'm Greg Gutfeld, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Monday, April 15th, 2024, I'm Mike Emanuel. A dangerous time in the Middle East as Iran launched strikes on Israel. As Israel plans its response, from an American perspective, there are also concerns about instability across the globe.
Well, right now, I think we're seeing the greatest level of threats of conflicts around the world that we've seen in a long time.
Mike Turner of Ohio is chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence.
I'm Dana Perino. The framers drafted the Declaration of Independence promising life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But what did pursuit of happiness truly mean to our country's founding fathers?
It's absolutely central. And the basic idea, the takeaway, is that happiness is self-mastery, self-improvement, character improvement, being your best self so that you can use your talents to the best of your ability and serve others.
And I'm Mark Thiessen. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
After Iran launched more than 300 drones and missiles at Israel, now there are concerns about escalation to all-out war. White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby says the president has focused on avoiding an escalation.
I will just say this. President Biden, since the beginning of this conflict, has worked very hard to keep this from becoming a broader regional war, to keep the tensions from escalating. Everything he's done, everything he's moved in the region, every decision, every discussion that he's had is all designed to not let this become a broader regional war, and that's where his head still is.
Before Iran's attack, President Biden warned the regime in Tehran.
What is your message to Iran in this moment?
Don't. But now the president's trying to convince Israel to, quote, take a win and claim victory after saying it stopped 99% of the Iranian drones and missiles. Danny Dannon, a member of the Knesset, defended Israel's expected response.
And in our neighborhood, if you don't punch back, it's irresponsible. And I think the leadership in Israel is aware of that it will be irresponsible not to retaliate, because it will create a new equation in the Middle East that Iran will actually dictate when they would start an attack, when they will end the attack, not only against Israel, against the other moderate countries in the region.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says there will be action in Congress to help our allies.
The House Republicans and the Republican Party understand the necessity of standing with Israel. We are going to try again this week, and the details of that package are being put together right now. We're looking at the options and all these supplemental issues.
As experts and analysts dig into an historic attack on Israel launched directly from Iranian soil.
Well, this certainly is unbelievable escalatory acts by Iran. It's unprecedented that Iran would be attacking Israel directly.
Mike Turner of Ohio is chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence.
But already we have seen through Iranian proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas have been undertaking attacks on Israel. October 7th, of course, Hamas's horrendous attack in Israel was funded by Iran. The weapons used were from Iran. The training used was from Iran. But this is absolutely an escalation that we're seeing in the area. I'm very concerned that the Biden administration fails to see that this regional conflict is expanding. As you have Iran, of course, funding the Houthis in Yemen, who are attacking commercial waterways. The Biden administration seems almost desensitized to this. We saw over 300 missiles and drones that were shot at Israel. The Biden administration seems to believe as long as you use missile defense to knock them down, the attack didn't happen. Well, the attack was real. It was intended to kill people in Israel, and I don't think Iran is going to stop.
The takeaway from President Biden seems to be he wants the Israelis to, quote, take the win. But we've heard from Israeli spokespeople that, of course, they're going to respond. Is this further evidence that the White House is not on the same page with our key allies in the Middle East?
So I don't think that the Biden administration has a realistic view of the conflicts in the area. the missile defense, which we helped Israel develop missile defense jointly. And, of course, we used our missile defense, as did the UK, to try to aid them in thwarting this attack from Iran. But a missile defense is supposed to be de-escalatory. It gives you the time and the space to determine what actions that you need to take. Mm-hmm. The Biden administration seems to think that missile defense in de-escalating actually means that there is no need for response. We've seen that when our troops were attacked over 100 times in Syria and Iraq. The Biden administration looked the other way, ultimately causing loss of life with U.S. service members in Jordan, because the Biden administration was failing to respond, failing to try to diminish the capabilities of those who want to do us harm.
Iran has also said it will retaliate against those who help Israel. How worried are you about direct attacks by Iran on American forces in the region, given that American forces played a key role in shooting down a number of those drones?
Well, I'm always concerned about the safety of our troops, but I do believe that Iran is incredibly vulnerable here, both in the weapons production facilities that it used to make the cruise missiles and the drones that were fired at Israel, and the ones that they're giving to Russia that are showing up on the European battleground in Ukraine. Those are valid targets that would, of course, diminish the ability for Iran to provide weapons to the Houthis, Hamas, and Hezbollah, and to attack Iran and to provide weapons to Russia and Ukraine. Also, their nuclear weapons aspirations, those are vulnerable to attack, and we should never allow Iran to become a nuclear state. I think Israel certainly has these on their target list. And also their oil production facilities, their export of weapon systems, their exports of oil, those also too have great vulnerabilities.
Majority Leader Steve Scalise says that the House legislative schedule will change next week to, quote, consider legislation that supports our ally Israel and holds Iran and its terrorist proxies accountable. Any sense of what that legislation could look like, sir?
Well, I think it looked like the package that has made its way already out of the Senate to a great extent, and that is providing additional missile defense capabilities, air defense systems for Israel, also looking to ensure that their F-35 systems are fully equipped and that they have weapons capable of being able to defend Israel. I think the number of capabilities that they already have as a result of cooperation with us really need to be just resupplied.
One sense I had over this weekend's events is this once again knocks Ukraine onto the back burner in terms of the world stage. What about support for Ukraine, and does this put Ukraine funding on the back burner once again?
Ukraine is at a critical point. I mean, it is very clear that Russia is is poised to be able to make advances in against Ukraine, and of course, in part using Iranian weapons. So these conflicts really are related in that you have, Russia and Iran working together, two authoritarian regimes attacking democratic nations. The speaker has made it clear that he would bring forward legislation to be able to provide the necessary defensive funding to Ukraine. And I believe we're to a point where that needs to occur. There will be, I believe, overwhelming support for a package for Ukraine on the House floor, just as there will be for Israel.
It struck me there was overwhelming support for Israel in the days after the October attacks by Hamas. But we've seen that soften from some of the folks on the progressive left. We've seen the president change in tone about Israel. How much of that is about domestic politics in a battleground state like Michigan, where there's a huge Arab-American, Muslim-American population?
It is very disheartening to see the White House weaken its overall support for Israel as they get critics who lean on the side of being anti-Israel. This goes to the basic values of democracy and standing up for allies. The United States needs to stand strong for Israel.
Mr. Chairman, obviously there are a lot of complicated situations across the globe, including as we look at China and its ambitions toward Taiwan. What are you seeing there, and how alarmed are you by the potential threat by China against Taiwan?
Well, right now, I think we're seeing the greatest level of threats of conflicts around the world that we've seen in a long time. The fact that this administration has shown weakness both in pulling out of Afghanistan, tolerating Iran's efforts in the Middle East, and its supporting Iran by giving them, you know, access to additional $6 billion in exchange for detainees, all of these are seen as a weak administration. Certainly, their weakness with respect to Russia and Ukraine, not fully standing up to Russia. And of course, that gives a signal to China, where China thinks, you know, this may be an environment that the United States' weakness would benefit them.
Do you think China is looking at the situation in the Middle East, the situation in Ukraine, and thinking the United States is distracted, and so maybe they should go forward?
I don't think it's an issue of just distracted, because we certainly have the you know, full capabilities. I think it's an issue of just weakness at the White House. John Kirby, in giving the White House response to this attack from Iran, was very weak. He said he did not indicate that there were any red lines. He acted as if because we were able to defend against over 300 drones and missiles fired directly at Iran, we should just pretend as if nothing had happened. We are facing escalation because the White House continues to portray weakness.
Mr. Chairman, as you know, FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, has become a bit of a political football here in Washington. Congress did reauthorize it with new reforms that were touted by former President Trump. What's the significance of the reauthorization, especially in a time where there are numerous foreign threats?
Absolutely. So FISA, the Foreign Surveillance Act, has within it a Section 702, which was expiring this year. 702 are provisions that are targeted toward collecting intelligence on foreigners abroad. It has to be both a foreigner and a person abroad. It's not Americans abroad. It's not foreigners here. It is foreigners abroad. This was still abused by the FBI. There were horrific abuses. So we put together a package of reforms that overwhelmingly passed the House to be able to put in place restrictions and real penalties, including criminal penalties on the FBI, if they continue to violate the basic principles of intelligence of our targets, our foreigners abroad.
Obviously, some Americans worry about abuse, but you sound confident that the reforms will make sure there's not abuse of FISA against Americans, both here and abroad.
We have included increased reporting requirements, oversight, and criminal penalties, which are severe. I believe that this is a reform package that's the most significant since FISA was first adopted. FISA having been adopted so that intended to protect Americans, we have now made it stronger. And I think it certainly will be something we're going to continue to monitor, hold the FBI accountable to make certain that American civil liberties are protected.
He is the chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, Mike Turner of the great state of Ohio. Thank you so much for your time today, sir. I wish you a great week.
Thanks, Mike. You too.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
This is Mark Thiessen with your Fox News commentary coming up.
The Declaration of Independence, signed by the country's founding fathers in 1776, promised a few unalienable rights that Americans would have. The founding document famously reads, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." A new book from a legal scholar and New York Times bestselling author explores the lives of 6 of our most influential founders. In the book, The Pursuit of Happiness, the reader is given a deeper look at the profiles of Washington, Hamilton, Franklin, and more. It explores what the pursuit of happiness actually meant to each of these gentlemen and what impact this crucial phrase had on our system of democracy.
I just noticed that both Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson had offered for their definition of happiness a quotation from a book by Cicero I'd never heard of called The Tusculan Disputations that said, without virtue, happiness cannot be.
The book's author, Jeffrey Rosen, is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center.
So I thought, gosh, I should read the Cicero book because it seemed so important. And then I found this amazing reading list that Thomas Jefferson would send out to kids who were going to law school and wanted to know how to be an educated person. And it had on it Cicero and these other works of classical Greek and Roman moral philosophy that I'd never read before. I've had this great liberal arts education, just felt it was a gap that I should fill. And I read them over COVID, and it just changed my understanding of happiness and changed my life.
That's what I think is so amazing when you said that it changed your life. And I want to get to that in just a little bit. But let's talk to people about, you know, what you do for a living is pretty incredible. And we're coming up on the 250th anniversary of our Constitution. And so tell people about the National Constitution Center, what you try to do there.
It's this amazing national treasure. It was created by Congress during the bicentennial of the Constitution to be the only nonpartisan constitutional education institution in America. And it's got an incredible website with an interactive constitution that's gotten about 80 million hits since we launched. And it's now the most Googled constitution in the world. And that brings together conservative, libertarian, and liberal thinkers, scholars, public officials to talk about every aspect of the Constitution. So you can click on any clause and find leading people like Justice Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Katyal with agreeing and disagreeing about the Constitution. We've got a weekly podcast, We the People, that talks about constitutional issues with liberals and conservatives. This amazing Constitution 101 class for learners of all ages, everything you need to know about the Constitution. A new partnership with Khan Academy to bring that class to hundreds of thousands of high school kids. And then there's the amazing physical National Constitution Center in Philly. If you're in Philly, come to Independence Hall, the most constitutionally sacred place in America, and come to the NCC and see rare copies of the Constitution, theater for kids, interactive exhibits. It's just constitutional heaven.
I think that one of the things that led me to want to interview you is I listened to you on another podcast, on Andrew Sullivan's podcast, and I feel like I had a decent education. It was fine. It was public school in Colorado. It was fine. And then when I got to Capitol Hill, and then when it worked at the White House, I really had to buckle down and read many more things that I had never even thought of. I had heard of Cicero. I had heard of Aristotle. Like, I had, of course, knew sort of vaguely about them, but I never knew that their writings were the foundation that led to what our founders decided for our nation. And I feel intimidated by your book, to be honest. And tell me why I shouldn't be, or how I should even begin.
Well, you shouldn't begin to feel intimidated because I didn't know that these documents were the foundation of the founding either. And it's my job to know. And I've had this incredible liberal arts education. I've studied politics, history, philosophy, all great teachers at great universities. I didn't know about these books because they've fallen out of the curriculum. And what's so amazing is they used to be core to what every educated American should know, not only in the founding generation, but during the Civil War, when people like Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln would read it in these books like The Columbian Orator and The McGuffey Reader. It was in New York City public schools up to around the time my mom graduated in 1950. And then it just fell out. And why it fell out is really an interesting question. Basically, our understanding of happiness totally changed during the 1960s from being good to feeling good, from the pursuit of virtue to the pursuit of immediate pleasure. And along with that huge shift in pop culture, there was a big change in the curriculum. And that's why we've lost these books. But for me, the whole project was both it was a great lesson in humility about how much more I have to learn. And also a reminder of the radically empowering project of reading primary text and the fact that all these books are now online and all of us can just find them if we take the time to read them is an incredibly powerful message.
Tell me a little bit about I'm going to ask you a couple of specifics. So in Cicero's paper that you talked about, the Tusculan Disputations, like, what was that about? How did that lead to anything that Jefferson wanted to include?
You know, it's so incredible how central it was. This was Cicero's manual on grief and how to deal with great tragedy. and his daughter Tullia had just died. He'd just been exiled from Roman politics. He goes to his villa in Tusculum and he writes this book saying that the way to deal with grief is to achieve tranquility of mind, to use your powers of reason to master your turbulent passions or emotions so you can achieve that tranquility of mind and greatness of soul that defines virtue, which defines happiness. And Jefferson copies it out when his dad dies when he's 14 years old. And then whenever anyone asks him what's the meaning of happiness later in life, he sends it to them. What's so important about the Cicero book is it inspires John Quincy Adams, who reads it in the White House after he after his son commits suicide, and he uses it to inspire him to be a great abolitionist. It's the core definition that John Adams also comes to late in life. It's absolutely central. And the basic idea, the takeaway, is that happiness is self-mastery, self-improvement, character improvement, being your best self so that you can use your talents to the best of your ability and serve others.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of particulars, before I ask you some final bigger picture questions, is about Hume's essays. And you say that he used the phrase pursuit of happiness twice. And is that where we sort of trace back to how we think about our founding now?
So glad you picked up on that. Hume uses it twice. What's really important is that all of the sources that I read use the phrase the pursuit of happiness. With electronic word searches, you can just quickly check it. And the Christian thinkers, the civic Republican thinkers, Blackstone on Law, the phrase is everywhere in the founding era. So it wasn't something unique either to Jefferson or Hume. But Hume is really significant. As you say, the founders quoted Hume's essays so often that some people thought they committed them to memory. And Hume's big idea is that it's possible to have a republic in a large territory with a system of representation, and that that'll prevent mobs from forming. And that's the centerpiece of James Madison's definition of faction in the Federalist Papers. He gets it from Hume. But the happiness part is that Hume says that personal self-government is necessary for political self-government. And unless we achieve calm, tranquility, and balance in the constitutions of our minds, we won't achieve that in the constitution of the state. And that central connection between private and public virtue is central to the founders.
Have you been following the reemergence of these classical education schools?
Yes, it's inspiring to see all of these kids rediscovering primary sources and their homeschools and their classical academies. The scholar Angela Parham at UVA has found that these classical academies were central to the Black intellectual tradition throughout history, and she's doing some great work there. There's a hunger for going back to first principles and rediscovering primary texts, and it's really inspiring.
It's pretty exciting. I have a young friend who is pregnant with her first baby, and last week there was an article about classical education schools, and there's going to be a new one in northern New Jersey, and she was interested because, you know, looking forward, there's just some really great, I think, information and data coming out about those schools. I was very good friends with the late Charles Krauthammer. And he used to recommend to people that they always study and read history because it helps you understand the present. And so for people who are feeling like the country is so divided and there's so many problems and they're feeling discomfort or unease about where we are in America, can reading your book that references these texts help people feel more confident about where we are today?
The answer is yes. First of all, it's so great that you were friends with Charles Krauthammer. I had the honor of working with him at the New Republic when I started as a kid, which Andrew Sullivan hired me for my first job. It was an amazing time. And Charles Krauthammer's lesson that history can teach us to avoid the errors of the past and also can give us hope for the future is correct. Of course, we don't know what's going to happen in America and democracy or around the world, and any of our ability to affect world events is limited, but what's so inspiring about it is we can always go back to our own resources, and regardless of what happens in the rest of the world, by mastering ourselves, improving ourselves, using time well, reading deeply, we can achieve our potential, contribute as best we can to the broader purpose. Every day is a new day, and it's a great empowering message of self-reliance, which is the core of the American idea embodied in the Declaration of Independence. And we're about to approach America's 250. And it's so important in these divided times that although we disagree about politics, we embrace the principles of the Declaration: equality, liberty, and government by consent, and above all, self-reliance. And we can do that with the inspiration of the classic texts and the examples of the great founders who read them.
And you're as inspiring today as you are as in the other interview I listened to. Thank you so much for doing this. My exit question for you is, you referenced that this project and writing this book has changed your life. Can you tell us how?
It's changed the way I use my time. And as I said, every morning now, and this is the crucial thing that I want to offer to readers and listeners, no browsing. You know, it's so tempting to just, you think I'm just reading the newspaper and stuff. But Jefferson said, I've set aside newspapers for Tacitus, the Roman historian, and I feel much better. I found that just by keeping those sacred early morning hours for deep reading, for creative work, I feel like I'm a better person and, in fact, am happier as well.
When you have your next song that you're ready to reveal, will you come back?
We'll spare everyone for a while, but I did have a solar eclipse song this morning. So when it's ready for prime time, I'll share it.
Jeff Rosen, I am no longer intimidated. I'm going to dive in, and I'm going to take it slow and absorb it all and the lessons that you have in here. Thank you for writing the book, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk with you.
Here's a look at the week ahead.
Monday is the federal deadline to submit individual tax returns to the IRS or request a delay. Also Monday, jury selection begins in the first of former President Trump's criminal trials. In New York, the former president is accused of falsifying business documents in relation to hush money payments he made to adult film star Stormy Daniels. The former president denies those claims. Tuesday, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments related to the January 6th Capitol riot. Joseph Fisher wants the nation's highest court to toss his conviction of obstructing an official proceeding, saying the law he violated only applies to crimes involving witness tampering. Also Tuesday, we inch one step closer to the Summer Games with the official lighting of the Olympic flame in Greece. There will then be a torch relay ahead of the start of the Summer Games in Paris in July. Friday, following the announcement of the Grammys, Taylor Swift drops her 11th studio album, The Tortured Poets Department. And that's a look at your week ahead. I'm Tom Graham, Fox News.
I'm Benjamin Hall, Fox News correspondent and New York Times bestselling author. Join me for my brand new podcast, Searching for Heroes. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts and leave a rating and review.
Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Mark Thiessen.
What's on your mind?
Donald Trump is under fire from some in the pro-life movement for his decision to oppose a federal abortion limit, declaring instead that abortion should be left to the states. As a pro-life conservative, I get the disappointment, but Trump is right. Let's start with the reason why we can restrict abortion at all today. Trump is the only pro-life president in six decades with a perfect record in Supreme Court appointments. The decisive 6-3 conservative majority he created overturned Roe v. Wade, the seemingly impossible goal of the anti-abortion movement for nearly half a century. As president, he defunded the UN Population Fund over its support for abortion in China, allowed states to withhold federal funds from Planned Parenthood, implemented the Protect Life rule, prohibiting Title X family planning funds from going to clinics that perform abortions, and defended the religious liberty of the Little Sisters of the Poor. And Trump was the first president to speak in person at the annual March for Life. No president more openly embraced the pro-life movement or delivered it more victories than Donald Trump. Second, he is being honest with pro-life voters. Passing a 15-week federal abortion ban is not possible in Congress anytime soon. That's because doing so requires 60 votes to overcome a Senate filibuster, and there is zero chance Republicans will win that kind of majority in the next 4 years. So campaigning on a federal abortion limit would be an empty promise to pro-life Americans, one that Trump would be powerless to fulfill. That has not stopped Democrats from demagoguing the issue. President Biden has warned that Trump will ban abortion nationwide. Biden served for decades in the Senate, so he knows that's a lie. By leaving abortion to the states, Trump takes this dishonest argument away from Democrats. Indeed, by taking a federal abortion ban off the table, Trump is turning the tables and positioning Republicans to make clear that Democrats are the abortion extremists. The Democratic Party used to treat abortion as a necessary evil that should be safe, legal, and rare. But today it is something to be celebrated in the Democratic Party, as when Kamala Harris became the first vice president to visit an abortion clinic. The new Democratic consensus, that taxpayer-funded abortion should be permitted up to the moment of birth is a position supported by less than a third of Americans. Republicans now can go on the offense on abortion and focus the debate on the Democrats' radical position. Finally, Trump is setting the pro-life movement up for victory in the long-term battle for hearts and minds. For decades, conservatives assured the American people that overturning Roe would not ban abortion, but simply send the issue back to the states. Voters now see many of those same conservatives saying they want to federalize the issue after all. They understandably feel misled. The pro-life movement needs to meet Americans where they are, not where we wish they were on abortion. Polls show that most want to keep abortion legal, but 66% support placing limits on abortion, according to a Knights of Columbus Marist poll in January. Support for restricting abortion has slipped as Americans have grown concerned about Republican overreach. The best way to bring those numbers back up is keeping the debate in the states, our laboratories of democracy. When abortion is decided at the state level, far more Americans end up with the abortion policy they want. Red states will get stricter abortion policies, blue states will have the opposite, and voters in purple states will demand a middle ground. And even at the state level, the pro-life movement should focus on incremental change as it seeks to convince more Americans over time of the sanctity of unborn human life. If pro-lifers push too far too fast, they will end up electing more pro-abortion Democrats who will take our country in the opposite direction. At the end of the day, this is all about the will of the people, Trump correctly said. And the best way to persuade more people to support the cause of life is to leave abortion decisions where conservatives once promised they would be decided, in the states. I'm Mark Thiessen.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.